it before. Where a government lies to a people, and a country is drifting to war. And there's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the doom to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone. And there are lives in the balance.
Listening to KHEN LPFM Radio 106.9 Salida, Colorado, and we're community supported radio, and we're streamed on the internet at khen.org. And if you'd like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest with Melody, they're available at www.givemesometruth.info or linked from the khen.org website. And if you'd like to send an email into the program for questions with our guests, our email address is khen.dj@gmail.com. I'm Melody, and my co-host tonight is Dr. Eric Carlstrom this evening. And you just listened to Jackson Browne, Lives in the Balance. And the views expressed on this program are those of myself and or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And, boy, I'm getting some definite feedback here on some sound, and I don't know where it's coming from. Okay, Dr. Carlstrom is professor of geography at California State University, Stanislaus, where he has taught physical and environmental geography courses since 1990.
And I guess after a couple of years, it doesn't hurt to, you know, kind of acquaint my audience with Dr. Carlstrom. And he was also a professor for 5 years at Northern Arizona University, for 1 year at the University of Kansas. His research has primarily been in the fields of geomorphology, soils, quaternary environments, and paleoclimate. Professor Carlstrom received his bachelor's degree at Northern Arizona University in 1971, where his major and minors were in anthropology, geography, and English. He's received his master's degree in physical geography at the University of Wyoming in 1977 and his PhD in physical geography at the University of Calgary in Alberta in Canada in 1981. And our guest this evening is John Hutchison. And he was born in British Columbia, Canada, and worked with machinery, Navy ships, Tesla machines, replicated Tesla lab, and has appeared on hundreds of TV shows showing his anti-gravity technology and has worked for many aerospace firms, DOD, Pentagon, as well as the Canadian Black Operation projects. His videos and documentation can be seen on YouTube channel John K. Hutchison 2008 and www.myspace.com/John K. Hutchison. Official MySpace website. Look, John, are you there? And Dr. Carlstrom?
I'm here, Melody.
Yes, and I'm here too, Melody. I can hear John very well, and you're rather faint. So
Okay, well,
if you could speak up a little bit, I think we'll do fine.
All right, and I'm just wondering, does somebody have a fan going in the background? Because that's kind of what I think I'm hearing. But
Not here.
Okay.
Not here either.
Huh, interesting. I don't even have one here. So usually there's one going. So, okay, Dr. Carlstrom, would you like to add anything to?
Yeah, if I could add just a little bit and maybe get us into the interview. Melody and I were honored and fortunate to be able to interview Dr. Judy Wood about a month ago, on the 14th of July. About what actually happened at the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001. I suppose we could subtitle that interview, Take Back Your Mind, because Judy really encouraged people to think for themselves and look at the data, look at the evidence for themselves, rather than let so-called experts tell them what was what. And in that interview, Judy was talking about her experience and why she began to look at the evidence of what happened at the World Trade Center. And then she talked about the process in which she gathered together some maybe 10,000 high-quality photos and began looking at all of the visual evidence. And she started discovering many categories of weird phenomena, as she puts it. And she was very confused. She said she was just about at the end of the road confused by these weird phenomena until she happened on the work of John Hutchison, who is our guest tonight. And she then realized that every one of the phenomena that she saw at the World Trade Center was also very similar to the phenomena covered under what's the so-called Hutchison effect. And so, in fact, she mentioned that John Hutchison has spent his career trying to replicate the work of Nikola Tesla. And what she's suggesting is that what we saw at the World Trade Center, which seems to suspend the laws of normal physics, is in fact perhaps the same physics using the same mechanism as the Hutchison effect. So we're very glad to have you with us tonight from Minnesota, John. Hopefully to talk about your association with Dr. Judy Wood, the Hutchison effect, and your career. Perhaps we could start off with, since we are kind of following up with this connection that you have with Dr. Judy Wood, could you tell us a little bit about your association with her and when it started and how that has changed kind of your or affected your research?
Well, I first met Dr. Wood actually in the latter part of 2007. She examined many of my metal samples and came across some very unusual patterns in them that I didn't even know existed in them myself. Normally, these samples are analyzed by Los Alamos National Laboratories as well as the Canadian Department of Defense, and other agencies would analyze them and send up and write up reports on them. But she did find out some very interesting aspects of the metal samples, such as non-magnetic stainless, which was partially magnetic in certain parts of the metal itself. These metal pieces would actually turn into jelly on video and turn soft, transmutate, and go into funny different types of colors and this kind of thing. So she was very interested in a lot of my contacts as well as the metal samples and what it could do. And she got to see this firsthand at my lab in Canada. And she took down a lot of notations and that kind of thing.
You've been working on these kinds of experiments for quite a while, I guess. Could you tell us how you got into this this field and maybe some of your background in it?
Well, I kind of got interested in the old timers, as they call them, like Nikola Tesla and other scientists of that time period, and replicating their work to the standards of that time. And when doing so, I came across some unusual effects, which I personally didn't think they were that interesting, but other people did. And they basically promoted it to the Defense Department of Canada as well as the DOD of the United States government just when Ronald Reagan was signing in the Star Wars program. So we were one of the first on the program to be interviewed and tested for what we're doing back in 1983. So that happened, and that lasted for about 4 months of tests, and they took all the videos and went quiet with it. But Colonel John Alexander has appeared with me on various TV shows in the 90s and as well as 2004.
Okay, and John Alexander is who?
Oh, John Alexander is a scientist, a researcher into psychotronics, non-lethal weapon technologies, as well as consultant to the Secretary of Defense. He's now retired, but we had a relationship for quite a while, since 1983 on up to present times.
And has your work kind of coincided, or is he off in total different areas?
He's interested in what I'm doing. He appeared in a TLC TV show called Strange Science, Science Frontiers in 1999, and then much later on in 2004 called Beyond Invention, where he's yet interviewed again. And his interests are in free energy, non-lethal weapon tech, and UFOs and other unique and wonderful things.
Okay, so John, based on what you said, that your association with Colonel Alexander goes back to 1983, I guess you had already established your research before that time and had found some very interesting things prior to that. So when did you actually start your research?
Oh, it had to have been in the 1970s. I was researching a lot of different things. And if it wasn't Tesla, it was machine tools.
Mm-hmm.
And I accidentally came across these effects in 1979. Mm-hmm. And they were mentioned to certain individuals who promoted them to the Washington State University, as well as SAIC in San Diego, Laser Group. And much later, we were funded for a black operations program. But I would call it a discovery program kind of thing. When Los Alamos, as well as Colonel Alexander, came up to Canada, actually, to see the effects for themselves, and videotaped everything for about 4 months, We had a team of about eight. There's some from Naval Labs as well as U.S. Army Intelligence and Los Alamos National Laboratories. And they took a lot of photographs, videos, and interviews, and all kinds of neat things.
So are you saying...
Now, as I understand it from talking to Dr. Judy Wood, a lot of your research involves interfering different wavelengths of electromagnetic energy. Would that be a correct statement?
Fairly correct, yes, along with electrostatic energy. These fields are modulated in certain aspects, areas, configurations. I'm trying to keep it as simple as I can for the listening audience, of course, but it's like a radiation field of multiple fields coming out and affecting things at a distance, maybe up to, well, I'd say 10 city square blocks. That's when I overdid it in 2007, and they got, City Hall got complaints in, and the fire marshal came and closed all operations down because the area was not zoned for levitation.
It sounds a little similar to an experiment that Tesla was doing himself in New York City, where, and I think even in Colorado Springs, his work kind of interfered with what other people were trying to live around.
Well, it did affect a lot of people, and the mayor of New Westminster was supportive of my work. He visited me some years ago, and then I guess City Hall was getting too many complaints of dishes falling around or other things happening, because I was actually pushing it to the max at that time. I've had like groups of film people come in and film it along with scientists like Dr. Thornton Ludwig, Al Beebe, Gene Manning, who wrote the book The Coming Energy Revolution, plus many other visitors, along with Tom Sky, who got affected by it. And at that time, also, a good portion of New Westminster got affected. And that's when the fire marshal came around the end of February in 2007 to shut it down, although it was previously inspected by engineers and fire marshals before passing all regulations. But the mayor said, Judy Wood was on the phone with me, that it wasn't zoned for levitation and that City Hall was getting too many complaints. So we complied.
And in fact, levitation was occurring?
Yes, all over the place and causing people to get dizzy and other things like that, which I kept records of all those correspondences and actually posted them on my blogger.
Interesting. So how this is maybe a kind of a trivial question, but how large were the objects that were levitating?
Well, they were pretty heavy in my place. So 1,500 pounds in the center core that was recorded by the Disclosure Project representative Harold Bernard in 2006. So that caused a lot of vibration within the building, but the fields would radiate out into other buildings and cause things to melt, levitate, shake and vibrate, and this kind of thing, where folks would actually go to the news media and report it, or they'd send in complaints to City Hall. So it's interesting.
So would you call these field effects, John?
Oh, they'd be field effects for sure.
Yeah, because a lot of what Dr. Judy Wood is talking about is what she also calls field effects. In order to try to explain the phenomena that she observed on all these photographs, she really investigated field effects, I think, in large part with looking at your work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think the average listener probably doesn't really understand what a field effect is. Could you maybe give us a basic explanation, please?
I could say you could probably light a handful of, let's say, ordinary, I was going to say something else, but steel wool. And would you be surprised it would keep on going until it burned itself out? Normally steel doesn't burn, but if you took a 9-volt battery and put it to fine steel wool, like Bulldog, it will catch fire and turn into a bunch of dust and powder. Now, that's quite a simple analogy, of course. But in regards to the effects I'm doing, it gets more exotic where you get into the subatomic realm and level. You're actually affecting the atomic structure. And also the subatomic area is affected, causing the normal matter to drastically change.
What other type of field effects did you that were experienced with your work?
Well, we've had like portals that opened up that were filmed on actually 8 millimeter film. We had distortions in metal samples. Huge pieces would turn into rubbery type of material. Some would turn transparent. Other things, most of the time, was levitation or movement of things. And unusual ball lightning effects, water floating in the air, and this kind of thing, which is luckily captured on some of it actually in high definition film. And all of this happens far away from the actual equipment.
So you are interfering various wavelengths of electromagnetic radiation intentionally, creating an electromagnetic field which alters the molecular structure or the subatomic structure of part of materials such that, like you say, they turn to jelly. Dr. Judy Wood talked about jellification and how you can get dissimilar materials fusing. You can get straw through trees. You can get straw through windows. You can get all kinds of what we would consider very strange effects in this situation. Is that correct?
Oh, very much so, yes. I mean, it's pretty strange stuff. On my porch there, the wood itself was starting to join itself together, which I thought was very strange.
So are these effects that would ever occur in nature?
Actually, I'm told they did occur in nature in the Bermuda Triangle, as well as an area that was investigated by U.S. scientists in Booker Bay, Australia. And there was a report written in 1995 by Dr. Hal Pudoff, as well as Paul Devereaux, on the effects in Booker Bay, which seemed to be mimicking the effects I do. So it appears it does occur in nature. And it's the report was not classified, but sensitive. And there was another report I got in 2005. It was from the South Pole group that investigated a time distortion. And there's a group of Russian scientists along with American scientists, and it was so, oh my goodness, hush hush, it went directly to the White House for some type of, I don't know what they do there with it, but this is all in email stuff I have with a lot of names of scientists. Because when they send up their weather balloons, all the instrumentation would go back in time about 35 years.
35 years?
35 years.
Wow.
Now, since I worked also for the Canadian Department of Defense and oh, many other places that are, well, black ops, I guess you call it. I have friends that email me information, and I have a lot of it, that I'll either post it or keep it hidden away somewhere. But mostly I post it on the Internet.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, one of the things that you talked about just now was things are affected at the subatomic level. Now, Dr. Judy Wood talked about the dustification of the World Trade Center. Sometimes I think she has used the words molecular dissociation, as if all of a sudden the atomic or subatomic particles, rather than attracting to each other, I guess with what's called the Casimir force, I guess she got that off your website, they start repelling each other and exploding apart to give us perhaps the kind of explosive fireworks that perhaps we saw on the morning of September 11th. Is that also one of the would you call that a field effect, or what would you call that?
With my metal bars that go into dust? I've had several metal bars that went into dust. They seem to just go into a darker or a white vapor, the top ends of bars, or they crumble into like a granular material, which was analyzed by the Max Planck Institute. So there's been a lot of that happening in some of these effects I do.
When you were talking about effects happening naturally in nature, did they have anything that they attributed to, like in the Bermuda Triangle or this, you know, in Australia or whatever?
No, they just would take all types of measurements of the area. They had Channel 4 from, I believe, the UK covering the entire adventure. And they'd have magnometer readings. And their observation would show that people were being pushed around by some invisible force, as well as strange lights appearing in the dark. And what else was there? Metal would turn funny and jelly. So I'm told. The official report shows a lot of activity, and I could never find anything. If a Google search out Booker Bay, Australia, I can't seem to find anything there on anything like that, but the report does exist. It was pointed out to me by Mr. Harrington, who saw one of my TLC TV shows and made contact to me and sent me the report. The actual Bermuda Triangle itself that we're all familiar with down there in off of Florida, it's got some unusual kinds of materials that they have. It seems to be all impregnated with other materials, like it's all jumbled up and mixed up. I actually was quite surprised when I read the book on the Bermuda Triangle and found that there's some very interesting similarities between the metal samples with deposits of wood in them, as well as the rubber tire samples from aircraft that vanished in the Bermuda Triangle that had all kinds of different things impregnated in the rubber material. Which is not mentioned. I don't think they mentioned that on some of those TV shows on the Bermuda Triangle. I've done maybe 15 shows on the Bermuda Triangle.
Mm-hmm. Well, if perhaps some of our listeners already are feeling a little over their head in terms of the non-traditional physics here, I wonder if we could back up a little bit for their benefit and perhaps ours as well, and that is, and start with the innovations of this guy, Nikola Tesla. I know he's credited with discovering alternating current. He's credited with discovering the radio. He wanted to deliver free energy to everybody in the world and thought he could, but his financing was cut off by J.P. Morgan himself. And he claims to have discovered a death ray, which some people think that that is something like that was perhaps used on September 11th. Could you shed a little bit more light on this individual and what you think his main contributions were to humanity?
And why you were interested in him?
Yeah.
I was interested in Tesla because of the fact that he dealt in high voltage that produced very unusual effects, so I went out to actually replicate it to 18th century standards, which I did do. And luckily I had a lot of surplus in Vancouver that was around that time period, as well as wire even around that time period. So I put a lot of work into replicating what he was doing, and also I learned too that George Westinghouse took on his ideas and incorporated it in his company, forming such things as transformers and Westinghouse power generation equipment for dams and dynamos, whereas Edison was opposed to all of that and was quite dramatic in his demonstrations in public of electrocution of animals to make people scared of alternating current. But again, Edison's system would have, you needed a power station every city block almost to try and push direct current through the system. So Tesla was quite advanced in his thinking. He was into radio, polyphase, multiphase systems. He built some unique detectors that could pick up radio waves from probably Jupiter that was measured by a small pin that would move up and down on what they call lamp black on a piece of glass. So he actually had a recording device, primitive in nature, but still it did work. When you got a little pin, let's say, moving on a piece of glass with black on it, it would draw out patterns of these signals coming into his antennas. Then later on he developed radio, which Marconi then promoted. And unfortunately, Marconi got all the credit for the radio work, but Tesla was quite a unique individual, and a lot of his work was carried on also by Dr. Robert Gocha in Leadsville, Colorado, where he started building Tesla coils at 30 million volts. And I think Robert's still at it, too.
No, we're about 60 miles from Leadville.
Wow.
It's cool. Yeah, beautiful town, Leadville, 10,000 feet, great mining town. You mentioned Tesla coils, John. Could you define what that is?
It's actually, Tesla coil is a very simple device. It's the outer core is wound on either a plastic form or even wood, and it's just very thin wire. And it could be wrapped 2 feet in diameter, anywhere from that up to 30 feet in diameter if you want, or even down to 2 inches in diameter, very thin wire. And on the outside is a primary coil, which is very thick wire, which is then put onto what normally everybody does is hook it up to a neon sign transformer with a capacitor. So what it does is step up the voltage to, let's say, a million volts. And anywhere from, well, let's just say a million volts on up to 30 million volts. It's like an amplification effect, a resonator.
And what can you do with that?
You make a lot of noise. You can, you can cause a lot of lightning bolts to fly around.
Mm-hmm.
Although, if it's very fine-tuned, you can use it as a tool, like with the HARP project in Alaska. Also, you can electrify the ionosphere, as well as transmit power without wires. And it's got many applications in television sets, electrostatic cathode ray tubes for primary supply of high voltage. So many different applications for it. It does come in very strange modern forms these days, of course, as a flyback transformer in most high voltage commercial stuff that needs that kind of power.
And Dr. Judy Wood, of course, analyzing these 10,000 some photographs from all kinds of sources, was following the trajectory of what she called fumes or fuzzy balls, which are very small particles that have actually broken down from larger particles due to whatever forces were unleashed on September 11th at Ground Zero. And notice, of course, that these white clouds drifted up high into the atmosphere. And so she looked at space imagery and found, much to her surprise, a huge hurricane off the coast of New York City, Hurricane Erin. And it's her hypothesis that this hurricane might have been guided there by people who know how to guide hurricanes and might have had some sort of a function in the 911, I guess you'd call it an operation, I don't know, and that this would be largely responsible for some of the very powerful and strange field effects, that the hurricane itself was like a gigantic Tesla coil. Are you, I'm sure you're familiar with that hypothesis, are you comfortable with that, speculation?
Well, I don't know about a hurricane, but I know that hurricanes and events and weather can be apparently affected or made to happen through Tesla technology, let's say through the HARP project. I have no proof of it, but I've been hearing a lot about it. I myself, in one experiment I did in 84, actually, it appeared to me that above me were clouds that formed a heavy rainstorm. And I thought, well, it's only coincidence, but I would then go back to what Tom Bearden, a friend of mine in U.S. Army, retired, would talk about standing columnar waves, which were produced by the Soviets, causing huge, gigantic clouds to collapse rain. And these were radio-style clouds that would build up and form streamers coming off of them. And I did see some of those, and also he would refer to cold hole explosions in space, as well as scalar waves interfering in weather patterns. And he had very interesting videos, as well as publications called Soviet Weather Engineering Over North America.
I actually just recently purchased that video, and I would recommend it. I need to watch it again to try to understand it better. But yes, the thrust of Tom Bearden's presentation, I think that came out in 1984, is that the Soviets were the ones that developed Tesla technology right through the Cold War, and used it, in fact, to control the weather over North America with, as you say, scalar waves and what he called the woodpecker. Very high tech, and he actually showed in that video about Soviet weather control over North America the principles of Tesla's so-called death ray, which in which you interfere two waves or two types of wavelengths and create a central area where the normal physics is suspended, and even he said time space is suspended as we understand it.
I know Tom did some experiments in his neighborhood too, and he made some slow down in time.
Yeah.
So yeah, he's a real interesting person as well. As far as your work goes, what do you consider the most interesting part of what you're working with?
I think perhaps the anti-gravity type effect. If it could be sustained for a long period of time, one could have literally anti-gravity, which McDonnell Douglas Aerospace Corporation wanted to fund it, but never got the funding. I think that the anti-grav is the most promising. I've had offers from the Kennedy Space Center people where they presented my work to the directors, but the directors, of course, are on a, I guess they're on their, how do you call it, a payroll or a normal way of doing business? Like, no, we got to stay with the rocket people who are supplying us with all the big rockets. We can't go side stepping off and doing this stuff kind of attitude. And then the U.S. Pentagon had a showing of my videos in 2006 to about 400 officers, I'm told. I wasn't there, but I was told this anyway. And I refused funding from them because I like doing the television shows because it's more fun, and I don't like actually 9-to-5 work. So no offense, guys, it's just that I prefer the fun stuff and doing the television shows.
So when you first started doing this, were you doing this for work or just for fun then?
Oh, it's just all for fun, really. And I never promoted it either.
Well, okay, so we talked about Tesla and some of his innovations. As I recall in what I read about Tesla, towards the end of his, or at the end of his life, he died in a hotel room, his papers were more or less confiscated by the military, of course, then would have been his ideas and patents would have been available to them. So then a lot of this technology then supposedly was advanced, perhaps, Now, you mentioned the Star Wars. Obviously, there's a gap in between Tesla's death, which I think is 1932 or 33, and 1983 Star Wars. There's a 50-year gap there in which other inventors were probably doing some very interesting things, too, along these lines. But as I understand, a lot of that technology and inventions were actively suppressed. But then along comes Star Wars in the 80s, and the U.S. government decides to throw hundreds of millions, billions of dollars, I believe, on this idea of a strategic defense initiative, supposedly to protect us from Russian missiles, which, of course, Tesla said he could do.
Mm-hmm.
What do you reckon, John, was the are some of the spin-offs of that incredible amount of federally supported research, much of which was Department of Defense related?
Oh, a lot of there's a lot of spin-offs on that. It never really stopped, the Star Wars. It just sort of turned on a different program, but it got into the many aerospace firms which worked on exotic aircraft, unique designs which are in part actually ion-powered craft that high voltage is used to extend the wingspan or confuse radar systems. That goes into unique power sources which are non-chemical batteries, such as battery replacement, anti-gravity technology, life extension technology. The whole list goes on forever with that. There's so much exotic stuff going on in that whole world of the SBIR, Small Business Innovative Program, and Department of Defense. It's incredible what's going on there. Laser tech, you name it. It's pretty exotic stuff. Computers without hard drives that use a scanning laser to a crystal block with the information already in the crystal block.
Interesting.
They're using that technology. This goes on and on. You can probably name anything, and they do have it.
Well, I guess indirectly I'm asking if all of those billions of research dollars bought us 911.
I don't know. I can't answer that. That's not my area of expertise.
You know, some of the things that you were talking about as field effects, a lot of those things have, you know, people you observe going on today. It makes you wonder if the government already does has this technology, and that maybe they're just fishing from you to expand out where they're at. Does that make sense?
In a way, it does. I've actually seen ion cannons in the sub-basements of the Nevada State University. I was taken there by Dr. Rauscher in the basement. She used to work with the U.S. government, and I saw these things down there, and so it was rather cool. And she said, if I come back, she'll show me one of them in operation. But I never went back to Nevada State University because she changed her roles in research, and Honeywell Corporation asked her to develop a force field for them, but she declined on that. She wanted all of the military-industrial complex people. But I have, like, other people approaching me which are involved in exotic things like back engineering alien spacecraft. Oh, I guess I can say his name, Gordon Novell, who I worked with in 2007. As well as I just got an email from him. He's looking for more engineers for his high voltage power supply systems. But if people Google search out Gordon Novell, you see quite a colorful character. I get along with him fine. He's tied into the back engineering of the stuff.
So
in other words, as far as you are concerned, sorry, Melody?
I was just going to say, you don't think that they've already back-engineered it then?
I think they have back-engineered all of that. Gordon wants to back-engineer it with his team.
I see.
Because I know some people at Lockheed Martin Skunk Works, which are doing very exotic things, but they can't really talk. They'll leak information once in a while, but they can't really go in public too much about it.
Mm-hmm. I noticed on your bio here, you don't seem to mention anything about a formal education.
No, I actually didn't go to school. I played hooky. I'm self-taught, really, and have no PhDs or anything after my name. I just say I flunked my coloring book and blocks. That's the way of putting it.
Well, you know, yeah, this certainly has helped you from falling into whatever groupthink you might have been corralled into in universities. In a way, it gave you a more open-minded capacity to look at things. So, in many ways, I think that may have been a blessing.
I think so too.
I guess that's what the Department of Defense thinks anyway. If they're knocking at your door. Tesla. Going back to Tesla, Tesla thought that there was energy in the quantum vacuum. That energy was there was an infinite amount of energy almost available, and all we had to do is tap into it. So, had we followed Tesla's vision, we might never have gotten married to fossil fuels. Coal, oil, and natural gas. We could have used the wireless energy from the quantum vacuum. Is that correct, or do you believe that's correct?
Oh, I do believe it. I have a friend, yet another friend, Dr. Franklin Mead, has patented a zero point energy collector. He works over Meade's Air Force Base, or he owns it, or his part in it. 1996, December 31. The first patent accepted by the U.S. Patent Office on a zero-point energy collector. I myself have been working on these power cells for, well, good grief, since 1993, and presented them to Japan on TV Asahi and then later on Discovery Channel. And right now I'm actively involved in teaching other people how to make them. And pretty soon they'll be out in the marketplace. So zero.
Oh, is that right? Okay, so you're talking about a device that is going to be on the marketplace, and it's called a zero-point energy collector?
That's what I call it. I'd like to call it more of an energy scavenging power cell in combination to, let's say, if you have 1,000 of them or 20,000 of them, you can actually perhaps power your house. So far, the people that I'm teaching all this to have come ahead with it about 1,000 times more than I have. So it looks very good. It can be done. And yet another friend of mine is extracting energy from the vacuum at 110 volts with a single pole in the air. And that's a machinist friend of mine down in Illinois who showed me a YouTube video today of him actually doing it.
Now, that sounds like a Tesla technology there.
It is a Tesla technology. He's just got a single pole in the air, and he's got some small Tesla coils. And in his video, he was able to show that he's collecting over 100 volts. So I find that quite interesting. Also interesting, too, another friend of mine who's a radio host, Art Bell, has been doing this also, and is up to 400 volts. And with a lot of heavy working amps, so I'm told, by Art himself. And he was building these arrays in his hometown of Pahrump, Nevada.
Now, is he still living there, or did he move to the Philippines? Or?
Well, he was trying to get back home, but he couldn't get in with his wife. And that was a debate on Coast to Coast when Art was on with Dr. Robert Coons, who's a friend of mine also. And Dr. Robert Coons was mentioning my work to Art. But Art's kind of a scientist type, too. He likes doing experiments with antennas.
Now, it also sounds like, do you get into the patenting of your work? Or, I mean, it doesn't sound like you're really into the monetary gain from it. You sound more like you're open in your information.
Oh, yeah, I'm quite open.
Okay.
I'm not really into the monetary thing. because I get paid here and there if I do a good TV show. That's cool. But I used to get paid. I got paid by the U.S. government guys in cash. As well as for demonstrations when I was with Ferris Technologies Corporation. But then I found that Discovery Channel and all these TV people pay very well when they buy footage from Griffin Productions at $75 per second. That adds up, like 10 grand in one day is pretty good money. And I did get funded actually a couple of times from Japan and Germany for development of the zero-point energy collectors.
Yeah, but even when you're doing those kind of experiments, are they not fairly expensive to try to get a hold of the materials and that sort of thing? Or so you would need that kind of somewhat kind of that backing or no?
Actually, it's I'd say it's in small funds range for getting materials.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the machinery that was kind of hard to come by, and all I wanted to do was prove proof of concept.
Okay.
And then let others carry it on into manufacturing.
I would imagine, John, that you've thought about the whole energy issues considerably, and you understand that our industrial society gets about 85% of its energy from fossil fuels, and actually still a very small percentage of our energy from what we call renewables. What would be the impact of some of these quote-unquote free energy technologies on our energy use, on our civilization? Could we power the whole everything we do with this energy, or are we looking at kind of phasing this thing in as we phase out fossil fuels? Or how would you envision a future that would use this kind of energy?
Well, I see that people are slow in grabbing it and are quite happy with oil, a lot of people. And change is always difficult, but I see it sort of like a phasing effect. I mean, it was best described actually in Denver, Colorado, when I was at a conference there at the Stanley Steamer Hotel with Dr. Hal Pudoff, who's an expert in the free energy, zero-point energy collection systems. And he said that the oil companies would probably change for the better. That's his opinion. So I see it slowly going into production in a way. I think things would be slow. I may be wrong, but it's up to the people if they want it or not.
Do you see the oil companies and the fossil fuel companies taking an active role in squelching this technology in the near future, or do you think that they will tolerate it as a competition?
I think they're going to have to tolerate it because it eventually will come. There's so many people working on the technologies around the world that they'll try and squelch it, I'm sure. Some people do that. But eventually it'll break out into the mainstream technologies because this stuff can go into factory production and come out pretty cheap. It's basically like the analogy of the first vacuum tube computer to the laptop computer of now.
But it sounds like they're far ahead of that already.
Oh, yeah, they are.
I mean, that's the one thing that is kind of sad to see is the fact that when they do kind of bring some of this technology out, it's kind of like old.
there's a lot of things happening, and it's accelerating exponentially.
Do you see a downside to this kind of energy collecting, health-wise or to the environment or anything like that?
No, I don't see anything like that because it uses natural minerals and it's very simple to make. Even if they were to disintegrate or explode, I don't see that even as an environmental problem, but perhaps it would even help the soil.
Okay.
It's a strange thing. I just sat down one day, thought, well, what would I do if I was on a desert island and needed a power source besides using lemons with sticking copper and zinc in it for power? I thought of rocks and got involved in that and basically learned, too, that other people were doing this years ago, such as Townsend Brown and his petroelectric effect, where rocks give off certain amounts of electrical energy and can be collected and usable, as well as the Westinghouse process of making electrics out of ordinary wax, where they take wax or tar and heat it to a vapor and then charge it with high voltage direct current. And what happens there is that when that process goes on, it will collect back into a solid form inside of a capacitor, so you have what you call a self-reactive material. And you've got to be kind of careful with these things, because you could get electrocuted. And interesting to note that a company, Fair Radio Sales in Ohio, were selling barium titanate cylinders to inventors and people that worked in free energy. And I had myself about 8 of these barium titanate cylinders, and I noticed that I got zapped quite a number of times with these things.
Well, it's not uncommon for people that do work around electricity and that sort of thing that they get the effects of it.
Because it's like a cylinder, ceramic cylinder, which is self-reactive. And I went into a bit of research recently on it, on the internet, and found out that there's a lot of people working on the race to zero point, as I call it. And even the phone company Nioka, however you pronounce that one, is working on a self-charging battery that will be out in a couple of years. They're going to try for 35 milliwatts, and they're using self-reactive material. And like also the ultracapacitors now that are out there, they can handle up to like 3,000, 6,000 farads per small unit that you can hold in your hand. It's quite amazing, the technology that's coming out right now.
Do these technologies, in your opinion, I think the traditional view of academics anyway is that you can't disobey the first and the second laws of thermodynamics, or the entropy law, that you can change energy from one form to the other, but there's always a loss of waste heat, and so you go from high quality energy to low quality energy. And therefore, according to the second law of thermodynamics, the conventional wisdom says you can't have a perpetual motion machine, you can't have free energy. So when you speak of these kinds of things, how would you explain that to somebody who would say something like I just said, which you would, of course, read in a lot of textbooks?
Well, I'm sure there is a lot of waste in all systems. Like, you take solar power cells, you got a form of free energy right there with zero point energy. It's just a higher frequency that you're collecting. And working in that range, of course, the energy that you get working at that extreme far range of the electromagnetic spectrum is, the output is very small compared to solar cells. But that's simply because of the technology is not really advanced yet in the public domain for capturing it. But working around that, using these power cells myself as scavenging for any kind of energy, increases the amount of energy that they can produce. So I think that there's no laws violated by this, and because you're just simply tapping into another energy source.
Right. Ignorance on this, but I read and hear about 77% of the universe is dark energy, and 15% is dark matter or whatever. Are we talking about that kind of quantum field type energy, or is this something else?
This is actually something else that goes all through the entire universe. It's a quantum jitter, they call it, and it exists even at 0 degrees Kelvin. You still get this quantum jitter effect, which can be explained through the Casimir effect.
Explain the Casimir effect a little bit.
Pardon?
Can you explain that effect a little bit, too?
Actually, it's a pulling together of two metal plates that are slightly charged, and the energy released from that seems to be greater than what's required. And then scientists got into crystallography and other experiments in this area when manufacturing barium titanate, let's say, or other compounds of crystalline nature. They take in the account or problems of zero-point energy interfering in the crystallization processes of many of these exotic compounds used in, actually in lasers and for transducers in sonar. So there's tons and tons of literature written on the problems of zero-point energy in the actual manufacturing process of these products. But Dr. Franklin Mead, of course, of Mead Air Force Base, he felt that using barium titanate round spheres would collect zero-point energy, and I think it does because IBM bought up all the patent rights to it. And also I've seen something similar in Austria when I was living with Dr. Peter Kokoschnig in Austria, who had a similar system. And I was shown these exotic kind of vacuum fluctuations and new types of energy. And I believe I got some, yes, I do, actually papers on it too from him.
Can I go ahead and give a station ID, and that you're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHEN LPFM Radio 106.9 Salida, Colorado. We're community-supported radio, and we're streamed on the Internet at khen.org. And if you'd like to listen to tonight's program or any of the past programs of Truth Quest, they're available at www.gimmesometruth.info or linked from the khen.org website. And tonight I've got my co-host, Dr. Eric Carlstrom, and we have a very knowledgeable and experienced inventor, or how do you describe yourself? John Hutchison.
I just call myself John. I have discoverer or historian, I don't know. People call me, I just let the TV people make up whatever they want to call me.
Well, speaking of TV, John, some of our listeners might be interested about some of the programs that you've done with the Discovery Channel, the History Channel, et cetera. And you mentioned these before our interviews to me. So could you just briefly tell the audience what shows have been done and perhaps are also available even for purchase from those outlets?
Oh, we have for History Channel, it's Earth Black Holes. That's available on DVD now, and upcoming in September will be on National Geographic TV and Film. It'll be the Bermuda Triangle. Is it real? Well, I'll be in it. And there's a show reel on that right now, and that's airing in September. There's also Beyond Invention, which is probably one of the best, and that's available at Griffin Film Productions. The actual DVD now is out there. That is still airing on Discovery Networks. I have, let's see, also on Fox, Ghost, Best Evidence Caught on Tape. That aired in 2000. There's TLC shows I've done. Actually, I try and trace down these shows to see where they're airing, but I do have the videos, and I take video clips and put them on my YouTube channel of all the shows I've done. It's still an ongoing process. But other channels to look at is Ark of the Covenant Revealed, www.bluebookfilms.com. I built a full working Ark of the Covenant, which aired on Discovery Channel about a year ago.
Do you have links from your site to the, be able to see these, all of them? You're talking
everything
about?
Is on, yeah, pretty much okay. Everything's okay. On MySpace.
And that's, you might give that address again?
Oh, it's www.myspace.com/John K. Hutchison, H-U-T-C-H-I-S-O-N. And
well,
my YouTube channel is John K. Hutchison 2008.
And I'll have links from the website when I put this program up in our archives.
Well, I have to follow up, John, and ask you about the Ark of the Covenant Revealed, because just by coincidence, I actually bought and viewed Raiders of the Lost Ark last night right here in my house. And, of course, I remember now vividly the scene of the Ark of the Covenant, which, you know, you get this brrrr sound, and Indiana Jones says, "Marion, don't look," and all this good stuff. It's a great scene. Could you briefly tell us what this program is about, Ark of the Covenant Revealed?
Well, I was approached by Blue Book Films to do, and often I am approached by film companies to do the impossible things which I love doing. So the Ark of the Covenant was brought up, and I said, okay, I'll do it. And we were about 6 months into production. I found a master wood carver and wood maker who had, I think, 3,000 board feet of acacia wood, which was the ark was made of. So we went to work, and we had our cameraman Rudy and others filming us working on this. I was planning it all out. And we tried voltaic piles that would deliver only 100 volts. Then I thought, no, I think we're going to go electrostatic with this thing. As time progressed, about 6 months into production, we had it all set up at a metal supermarket store in Richmond, British Columbia, for the final grand finale test, which everybody phoned me and said, good luck, kind of thing. This is either make or break the show. So on a very cold day just after Christmas, these other friends of mine that owned the metal supermarket, we got ready, and we electrostatically charged it. And going on the principles that it, during carrying these units in the desert, they would build up a huge electrostatic charge. Well, it did. And it discharged in around, I'd say, close to anywhere from 50 to 100,000 volts. It sent out sparks and flames all over the place. And kind of freaked out some people who took fire extinguishers to it.
Yeah. Okay, so so the premise, I gather, would be that here you have the Ark of the Covenant, which, of course, is a very important sacred object in the Old Testament and, of course, has lots of spiritual meaning or connotation, and you're finding a naturalistic explanation for why and how this thing might have behaved as it did. Is that it?
That's what I was trying to do. I'm going also on ideas I was told by some other people I know that they replicated the Ark in a university and it got so dangerous they had to dismantle it. But yes, this thing was, I would say, would kill a person if they touched it. We know that.
But
whole show, Ark of the Covenant Revealed, or Ark of the Covenant, is about an hour long, and it covers a lot of interesting detail, the manufacturer of it, design and what we thought about it, and then, of course, the end of it. But it was extremely dramatic at the very end. We even had entities come out of the actual Ark itself.
Ooh.
Which,
well, that's very interesting. A bit like the movie, huh?
Getting pretty close to that. We had a lot of other... There was many hours of entities in there, but it was so edited down that it just showed a couple of seconds of these things flying around. But it was a lot of fun doing the impossible. And the other project that I was doing was the Philadelphia experiment, and I got some minor results of the model ship in 2006. It was going to be for Fox TV, and my producer Robert Drake and Kevin Albar are still working on that. In the meantime, I'm doing my own TV shows in Minnesota here.
Okay. Well, as I understand, the original Philadelphia experiment involved the disappearance of a full-size battleship.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
That's correct.
And what, back in the 1940s, and was it a military operation or was it a Tesla operation? What was it?
It was basically a military operation. It was called Project Rainbow, and they tried these experiments with disastrous results. Now, of course, I'm skeptical myself, and I had to prove it myself to see if it's true or not. Now, the only thing I've gotten so far is lightning coming off a foot-long model ship in water, and the water starts levitating a little bit in there, which luckily it's all videotaped. So
I've seen that one, I believe. And
I have as well. And what's going on there is what? Again, interfering different wavelengths of radiant energy?
Basically, that's what's going on there, and I thought maybe it would vanish, but I maybe have total 2 hours of that, but only a small amount that you can ever put on the internet. So there's some scenes in there that are pretty weird looking, or it appears to phase in and out, but you can't really say that until you get it analyzed, or perhaps a film company could get it into high definition.
Now, would you say that it disappears, or it just appears to disappear?
It appears to. I can't prove anything, you know. We've had metal samples that would disappear and appear somewhere else.
Because that was supposed to happen to that. It actually showed up another harbor, correct?
That's correct, yes.
Mm-hmm.
We had similar things happen in the big labs.
Now, would you attribute that somewhat to a time going forward or backwards in time or something of that sort?
I think I think it is related to time distortion. Some incredible thing we're tapping into blindly, I would say, because you just never know sometimes with the stuff that I've been fairly lucky. I haven't thrown myself out of the window. But Tom Sky was not that lucky when he was filming. He got hit by the fields, and he had to actually go to the hospital. He was interviewed by my scientist friend Ken Shoulders, who does charge cluster technology, and I believe Steven Seagal, actor friend of mine, interviewed Tom Sky because of the energy aspects of it. So a lot of people were involved interviewing Tom Sky, and Tom sent these email messages to me, which I thought, well, okay, I'll put them on a blog spot somewhere. But after some months, he got well again, but something happened when he was filming up here, and it's the same time that everybody in New Westminster, I shouldn't say everybody, but a good portion of the population felt something happen there, because being rather interesting, I would BCC a lot of people, and they make comments back saying, well, this might explain what happened in New Westminster. And these were from doctors, so I'd go talk to some doctors and say, yes, something did happen at that time. What it is, we don't know. I said, oh, okay, I'm just curious kind of thing. So the paranoia kind of grows, and everybody starts pointing their finger at me, saying their plants are dying, and when sometimes it's just a plant that's dying. You know, it kind of goes funny that way. And word gets out about this kind of stuff. It could feel like a Baron von Frankenstein, you know, with people coming with their torches.
Now, one of the things you probably encounter, too, is that, I mean, because I've noticed that in some of your sites, is that you get some kind of, you've had some break-ins or things of that sort where your equipment disappeared or that sort?
No, that was more of a problem I had in around 1990, approximately, when I was going off to 89, but it made the news in 1990, the front page of the Vancouver Sun newspaper, where I was shipping the lab, and it was all supported by groups in Austria and Germany, but it was intercepted by the Canadian government that didn't want a foreign technology going to these countries.
Okay.
So they seized the lab, put a fence around it, and basically the signs say, keep out. This is all documented in newspapers. And it's kind of a mystery. And that's one time. Another time was in 2000 when the police came in and did a raid. But it was more, I think, more for checking on certain things, and then it just vanished because that's the time they brought in the fire inspectors and electrical engineers and photographers and other people. Then they simply vanished and returned some antique firearms I had, and because I'm a gun collector too. And it was during the actual film shoot of Ghost Best Evidence Caught on Tape for Fox, but not at that exact time, but there was a filmmaker there from Miramax Motion Pictures who was going to be doing an extensive story on my life, which is many attempts have been done. Latest being Tracy Boyd and Michael Grace, I believe his name is, who did Poltergeist. But that, nothing ever happened there either. So anyway, it's just all these odd things happen like that, but no great problematic thing except in 89.
Okay.
So there was a court order stating that the lab should not be harmed in any way, but nevertheless, the Canadian government seems to don't care about court orders. Extremely long story on that one.
Well, going back to your connection with Dr. Judy Wood, John, I get the impression that she has become very interested in your work, perhaps more so than you have become interested in her work. But would you think that would you agree with her conclusions that directed energy weapons were used on September 11th and that there were field effects that are apparent in the data, in the evidence?
Well, I've seen a lot of samples that she supplied in photographs, which I thought were quite similar to mine, but I can't say, you know, who did whatever on 911.
Right.
I don't know. I don't think anybody really knows. I mean, I've heard the stories where, which is totally stupid stories, like, oh, they use thermite. I'm thinking, yeah, right, that's pretty crazy. You need to fill half the building up with thermite to make it do anything. Or they use dynamite or something to blow it up. Why would they do dynamite? I mean...
So you're saying there's technology out there that would be much much more efficient than what the going explanation reveals.
Well,
in other words, directed energy weapons probably have been developed that could accomplish what we all saw on television on September 11th, to actually turn the buildings to dust and have them come down faster than the speed of gravity. And these are two of the largest buildings in the world.
I know. All one needs is a high-powered laser, which they have, and or a particle beam, which they have, too.
They need is a high-powered laser and a particle beam, which they have, and then perhaps a hurricane nearby as a catalyst, as Judy Wood suggests, or do you think the hurricane might not have played a role?
It must play a role somehow because it's so unusual to have a hurricane there, as well as what interests me really was a magnetic dip in the Earth's geomagnetic field at that exact moment.
Yeah.
No, I guess I missed that part.
She got that data, and plus she's done incredible amounts of research and data.
Yeah, that data comes from Alaska, does it not?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, I think there's a recording station in Alaska where she noticed the change in the Earth's magnetic field at that point or something like that.
She has done
an incredible amount of research, and the implications, I think, are significant, which is that these weapons have been developed. They can be used on very, very large targets, and they can have devastating consequences. And whoever actually carried out the 911, I guess I'll call it an operation, since there has been nobody really convicted, is capable of pulling it off again at some other point. And that's why she, of course, is so motivated to do the research and to get the word out. In other words, to try to forestall, prevent perhaps another such occurrence. Would you agree with those things?
She's a very brilliant scientist. I respect all the work she's done to date. I don't know how, you know, that's good grief, that's really saying something about the government. If they did it.
Well, she doesn't even go there. She doesn't want to assume the identity of the perpetrators, and says, in fact, she laid out several scenarios in our interview that it could be a handful of individuals, and it might not be the U.S. government. But certainly the technology is there. Certainly it could be used again. So her strategy is to try to educate the public in order to make this a safer world. She feels like this technology could have devastating consequences for the country, for the planet, even for the species. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that, too, if it was in the wrong hands.
I think,
I think the Iraqis had it because the Russians went in there during the invasion into Iraq and were retrieving, this made mainstream media, were retrieving the e-weaponry technology and scalar weapons.
What was this?
Oh, this was on when they were advancing on Baghdad. The Soviets went in there and they pulled out all the information and documentation.
Are you saying when we went and was advancing on Baghdad, or they?
Oh, the U.S. and other forces were advancing on Baghdad.
Oh, okay.
In 1991 or in 2003?
2003.
Okay.
2004 time period. I heard it right on regular mainstream media.
And say that terminology again, the E what weapon?
It's called E-weapon technology and scalar wave technology.
And the E probably stands for?
Well, that'd be E-bombs, the bombs that go off and destroy all electronic devices, electromagnetic pulse generators and that kind of thing.
Okay.
It's
electromagnetic weapons, which are a reality, and I suppose they're a reality for many governments. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I've seen a lot of stuff, and when I was traveling in Germany and as well as Japan, they're very advanced with that kind of stuff over there.
Well, I find it real interesting that, you know, if we've got that kind of technology out there, and yet when Dr. Wood started revealing her findings, that they were so quick to ignore her and or disregard what she was pointing out and to come up with this technology that you find absurd.
Well, I noticed they really got upset over certain things about their thermite ideas, and which is totally crazy. I don't know what's wrong with some of these people. And you get the most, how do you call them, cyber flamers going berserk on her, and anybody associated with her. They just go ballistic into a psychotic rage. And I got caught in that a little bit with a gentleman by the name of Ace Baker, who challenged me to $100,000 to levitate something for him. I said, oh, for sure, this is easy money. So I called in my team. I called in CNN as well as a retired doctor from DREP, Defense Region Establishment Pacifica. We all filmed at my place, but Ace Baker never showed up. And I never got my $100,000. I signed his agreement. I said, sure, not a problem. Come on up and film what you want to film.
That's a good story, John. For our listeners, Ace Baker is one of the 911 researchers who has talked about how video fakery could explain what we actually saw on TV on September 11th. What we saw was not what really happened. There was really some video sleight of hand. He's not the only person to advance those ideas, but he has been a particularly vicious critic of Dr. Judy Wood, saying he hates her and things like that. It's very unfortunate that the 911 movement or the people involved in the quote-unquote 911 truth movement have become so hostile towards each other, and especially towards Dr. Judy Wood, who, as far as I can tell, her background and her research methods are impeccable, and her results are pretty hard to argue with. So I guess that this there would be a direct correlation between maybe her accuracy and the degree of attack if in fact people don't want to admit what's really happening.
Well, yeah. Another thing I found interesting too is you had Bob Bowman, who was supposedly involved heavily with the Star Wars project, but I never really heard him state anything to reveal there is a potential to have taken place with that type of technology.
Anybody in the black world will not admit anything. They will not acknowledge it. That's their motto. That's their thing that they like to do.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, there. Yeah. I just had a cough, but they will not acknowledge it or deny it. So, nope.
Go ahead, John. Sorry.
I had a journalist friend, actually featured in his book called The Race to Zero Point by Nick Cook of Jane's Defense Weekly, who interviewed some of the black ops people who said, no, we can't talk about it. We can't deny it, or and that kind of thing. It was called The Billion-Dollar Question. That's when Nick went around for a one-hour TLC TV special and interviewed all these different people in the black ops world. Very interesting. And then he wrote a book on it. His adventures, and I'm featured in the book, by the way.
Well, you know, I think we start to see a pattern here, and Dr. Judy Wood had a quote by Lenin on her website. I'm not sure if she still has it, but it was something to the effect that the best way to control the opposition is to lead it ourselves. And I'm not, of course, this would be speculation, but she herself has instigated a lawsuit against the contractors who wrote the NIST report, that is National Institute for Standards and Technology, which is a government report. And the contractors who wrote the report, supposedly to explain why the towers came down, she's suing them for defrauding the American people because they didn't answer the question of why the towers came down. But the people that wrote the report were, in fact, the experts at directed energy weapons. So mm-hmm. if you get the people most qualified to do the cover-up, most qualified in the technology to actually do the cover-up, then you've pretty much sealed all the options, because they would have the expertise and know how to hide things perhaps better than anyone else. I think that's rather incriminating. She said that her lawsuit names 23 corporations, most of whom are defense contractors. So, again, although this does not implicate them in the operation, perhaps it certainly implicates them in the cover-up of 911. And so this apparently is the lawsuit that she and Reynolds,
Morgan Reynolds,
yeah, the guy who's come up with the no-planes hypothesis, he's also part of this lawsuit against NIST. So anyway, that's just an indication, I think, of maybe the power of some of these black ops, et cetera.
So with that court case of Dr. Woods, it means that they would have to open up their books to what they really have in their arsenals, and that's something they do not want.
How familiar are you with the HARP project?
Be pardon?
How familiar are you with the HARP project, or are you?
Well, actually, I'm very familiar with it. I know the people that wrote the book on the HARP. The Angels Don't Play This HARP, Gene Manning.
Uh-huh. Well, wasn't Dr. Nick Begich involved, too, or was he?
Yeah,
okay,
Nick
right.
Begich. And I got really involved in that with Gene and friends, and they actually use the Schumann cavity at 8 cycles per second and using Tesla technology. And if they were to make a mistake and punch a hole through the Van Allen belts to reach, or sorry, the ionosphere to reach the Van Allen belts, so cause a Ben Franklin effect, which would be a massive bolt of energy coming down that beam and hitting and stalling the Earth's geomagnetic field. This is something I read, and it was published by a physicist called Junerman in a military book called R&D Innovator, which I have a copy of it. So the HARP thing, I'm quite very familiar with it.
Why do you think they built it? For that reason?
I don't think that self. I don't think they wanted self to destruct themselves. I think it was mostly used for weather monitoring, as well as submarine communication. But they realized that they can do all sorts of fun things with it, as well as trying to manipulate storms or stop storms. So it's quite a versatile piece of machinery up there in Alaska.
Uh-huh.
And here there's a few more around that are kind of top secret that are in operation. But that's if somebody who's really evil could possibly punch a hole through the vent or the ionosphere and cause that to happen. But I mean, that's crazy, but it's probable.
When you mentioned earlier, you mentioned something about portals. Were you saying holes or portals of a different dimension or something? I couldn't quite...
I think it was another dimension that appeared that luckily was captured on tape, Super mm-hmm. 8 millimeter film. It appeared a number of times over the years in the big lab setups, as well as in around 2004 in the smaller lab setup. What appears is multicolored things, as well as the smell of ozone, but it's very momentary.
Mm-hmm.
And for some
Is this intentional? Is this accidental? How are these other dimensions called forth?
Oh, they're just purely accidental things that happened. Mm-hmm. I didn't get too scared when that happened. I don't know why, but I didn't. And luckily it was recorded a number of times by the scientists I was working with, Alex Pizarro, as well as George Hathaway and myself and Alec and George, who has X Energy Corporation, an oil finding company, which is kind of strange, but we saw all these crazy things in these lab experiments. And really, it's kind of intriguing in many ways. It means perhaps quantum physics really is real.
Well, you've known so many different people in the past. Would you have known Al Bielek?
Al Bielek, yeah.
Yeah,
I know him.
And what was your relationship with him?
We're actually, at that time, when phone communications, he sent me some materials on the Montauk Project and Philadelphia experiments.
Uh-huh.
And we're trying to help also Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher getting back from J.R. Reynolds III's estate back to Nevada, because J.R. Reynolds III... of the tobacco family people. He was very interested in this stuff. And when he passed away, of course, the Reynolds family won Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher out of there, as well as another scientist. It was a very traumatic event, actually. And so we got a fund for her. I worked with William Tiller on it, and we sent the money to her to get her back to Nevada. So that's when I verbally talked with Al Bielek, who was very helpful in helping out with that situation. The J.R. Reynolds people were very mean to them, and because when you'll find in these great name families kind of thing, there's a black sheep involved in with this kind of thing. So Al Bielek was quite helpful.
Now, I've heard him speak about the Philadelphia experiment and being involved in it. What do you understand he experienced or his involvement?
I'm not too sure, but there was experiments conducted at Montauk Base. And oddly, I got involved by the New Westminster Police Department through that in 1997 when a parcel was delivered there. And the New West cops called me down. I brought Gene Manning as a witness to it all. Because at the Montauk base, he found a package addressed to me. And it was to be sent back to me somehow, but they thought it was a bomb inside of it, so they took a water cannon to it, the New York Police Department. So Constable Ted Usher of the New Westminster Police Department phoned my landlady as well as me and went on and on about this thing, and is John a good guy, blah, 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 kind of thing. I thought, what is going on? So I phoned up Gene Manning and said, well, you want to come with me to a real X-Files adventure with the New West Police Department? So she came and we talked, and he's showing me documents on dilithium crystals, which I knew about, that came from Fort Worth, Texas, and other documents. And that's when I learned about the water cannon stuff and the abandoned Air Force base. Why would it be a package delivered there? And very confusing stuff. And I said, well, you know, this is interest me. Can you give me more data on it when you find out? And he said, well, yeah, he would do that. And then Gene Manning and him talked about the history of the New West Police Department, because they're both authors, and she's writing a book, and as well as Ted Usher, Constable Ted Usher, on the history of the New Westminster Police Department. So he promised to get me that information, but never did, and I went through the Freedom Information Act and never heard a response. It was like it was all sealed up and kept quiet.
Did you ever find out? Oh, you said it had dilithium in it? Is that what you said?
It had papers on dilithium crystals.
Okay.
Which I received in 1993 from Fort Worth, Texas, from William Warren. And these things seemed to follow a trail of their own with various girlfriends I had until they wound up with Nicole Whitney, who's a radio host for News for the Soul. She is now in possession of them. But to go into what these things did to people would be almost another radio show, I think.
Well, I bet you have all kinds of stories.
Oh, caseloads of stories, let's say. I feel like Fox.
Well, John,
Mulder,
I've got... Go ahead.
I feel like Fox Mulder sometimes.
Well, I downloaded some articles just on the internet here about directed energy weapons and electromagnetic warfare, including some, let's see what we got here, including some things on Tesla's death ray gun finally comes to life, lasers, microwaves, energy weapons, not just for Buck Rogers anymore, 2003, Tesla's death ray in 1940, New York Times,
mm-hmm.
Tesla's death ray, a weapon to end war, and then here's an article, How Did the Twin Towers Collapse, talking about possible use of lasers and microwaves. Here's one by Matthew Mothorpe, The Revolution in Military Affairs and Directed Energy Weapons.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what is becoming clear from some of these titles is that what many people would perceive as science fiction is now science fact.
Oh, absolutely.
And there's one here called Introduce Mind Control and Directed Energy Weapons.
There's an interesting website for that one. It's PSI Tech.
I think I've been to that one.
Yes, you're right. Peacepink.ning. So mind control is also a possibility. Is this something that you're familiar with?
Oh, yeah. Colonel Alexander is involved in that since his first article in Military Review called The Mental Battlefields. That's a long time ago. He goes into a lot of interesting details on that, and they've been studying this for a long, long time and developing technologies to influence people at a distance.
Now, is this something they did at Montauk, too?
Me, pardon?
Is that something they may have done at Montauk?
Oh, probably.
Okay.
I mean, it's all electronics in some ways, psychotronic warfare is a big issue in the military-industrial complex, as well as it's interesting to mention about directed energy weapons that now you can have a small marker pen-sized laser that's called an astronomy laser. You can point it into the sky. It's out in the market for $130. You can use it also to burn things up in your home if you want to be nasty about things. And also, particle beam weapons are actually on YouTube, demonstrations of them. And one fellow had a gun that was a particle beam gun that lit a candle on fire. So all this technology is pretty well even in the public domain, but the big, huge ones are kind of in the military-industrial complex's domain.
That's the sad part about it. It seems like a lot of these technologies are kind of funded and run through there, and quite often we don't hear about them for many years.
Average about 10 years in the future, you eventually hear about them.
And see them.
Oh, yeah. But there are more and more people leaking stuff out.
Do you think that's something that by accident, or do you think that they want it to be leaked out?
I think they just are either close to retiring or they're just tired of all the stuff and they leak it out. And since I'm kind of a prime time target, so to speak, they leak. I get a lot of leaks coming out to me. Some of the stuff is actually coded information, which I haven't been able to decode yet, but I mean, people, I guess they watch TV even in locations like that. So, oh, there's that crazy guy John there. Let's send him an email or some weird thing or whatever, which I do get.
Now, when Dr. Carlstrom talks about these directed energy weapons, is there some that's invisible and some that you can see?
Both, actually. There's an X-ray laser they were playing around with in the 80s. It was Dr. Rudy Buser who was working on that principle. And that's something that's quite deadly, but it needed at that time a nuclear blast to set off down a solid bar of metal, a X-ray lased cannon type effect.
Now, there was talk of some type of mini nukes or something that could have possibly been used on the towers. Does that sound like anything feasible there to you?
Oh, yeah. They have that out for years. They use them actually in conventional cannons. They just fire a shell that has a mini nuke and it'll blow up a huge, well, many square blocks of whatever.
So apparently they're not too worried about radiation anymore.
Well, they do have cannons that'll fire these things, mini nukes, as well as I'm told by a friend that satellites can monitor the movement of any nuclear material. He's Special Forces Afghanistan.
Which I always thought was kind of an interesting thing in its own right, with them threatening that, you know, they've got all these nuclear weapons loose in this country, and yet they're not tracking them. I mean, it would seem to me that that would be a high priority and that they could do it.
I think they can track it, if I'm told by my friend there, they can track it by satellite.
Yeah, that's what I understand. So, and are you working on anything currently?
Actually, working right now on these zero-point energy power cells.
Okay. And how do you... But you said you needed a whole bunch of them. So is there going to be a more efficient way, you think, for us? Or is this something that's going to be you just need a lot of to make use of them?
I think the idea is to make proof of concept and then take it to a factory that could go into production and manufacture these things.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually supposed to... been doing that with Charles Bombardier in Quebec, actually covered by Fox TV, but one of my producers never had a broadcaster yet to go there. It was going to be called the Experimental Factory, where we'd have a self-powering house. And this was last year, I believe, that all this was going to happen, but has not happened as yet. So here, people I'm with have advanced this about 1,000 times more powerful than what I wanted to actually go for. Because I'd only carry it so far and say, well, here's proof of concept, one under 1 milliamp of energy at 1 volt. Now it's your turn to take this to engineers and have them scale it up and put it into a way of manufacturing them. So
you sound like, when you were a kid, you sound like somebody I'd have been afraid to lock in the room and come back and find out what you might have drummed up.
Oh, good grief. Well, as a kid, I used to have a chemical laboratory. When my doctor came in when I was sick when I was a kid, he said, it looks like a pharmaceutical company. If it wasn't that, it was cannons. I loved cannons, making them and firing them off in the backyard, along with artillery pieces from the Civil War time period. Just crazy that way, I suppose.
Well, John, so much of the work that you're doing, and of course Tesla's work depends on the electromagnetic spectrum, interfering wavelengths of different waves of different wavelengths. How do you generate these various wavelengths, say in your laboratory?
Well, I used to use a long time ago the Tesla system of Tesla coils and static generators along with radio frequencies, and as I progressed onward, I started to eliminate a lot of the Tesla coils and was able to replicate the same waveforms with what they call a signal generator system. So I'd get the Navy surplus signal generating systems and build my own, actually, and was able to refine it to the point where the effects were more per hour. Then when the big lab disappeared, I rebuilt the lab again and was able to do it on demand. When the film crew would come in and film, I'd sit down and tune everything up, and they'd film the results. And Rob Simone was a guest at my place, along with 8 people from Polar Shift Film Productions, and caught a canister levitating for 15 minutes in the air, which is pretty good work, I think.
Yes. Now, can you predict what's... Can you dial in particular wavelengths and say, okay, now I want to generate near-infrared at such and such a wavelength with this signal generator system, and then I want to generate microwaves at such and such a wavelength with this one here, and then I want to send both of those energy beams or streams towards a common target, and then see what happens when they interfere. Do you have that level of control?
Oh, very much so. With what they call universal magnetron power supplies and universal power frequency meters and generators, you can dial in any type of frequency, amplitude, and wavelength and sweep generators. A lot of that military surplus equipment or the Navy ship stuff is very useful and versatile that way. And a lot of it I got from the University of British Columbia, because they'd be using it to program microwaves and magnetrons.
Your next question is, have you, I suppose, with your experimental research, you are at the point now where you can predict what's going to happen to certain materials when you use particular wavelengths focusing on a particular target. Is it replicable? Does it happen the same way each time, or do you get unexpected results using the same wavelengths?
Excuse me. I sometimes get unexpected results. I got jelly metal happening again. But it was within minutes once I turned everything on. And what I did do was leave everything turned on and have massive amounts of extension cords to one big central block that I'd push the whole thing into this block that would power everything up. So when a film crew came in, I would just sit down on the by one of the control panels and start working them a bit. So the results were pretty fast and sometimes unexpected, but it kind of scared the National Geographic TV film people because Nancy O'Donnelly hair started to stand up. They all stopped filming and said, "Oh, are we going to be okay?" I said, "Yeah, no problems. There have been many film crews through here that are okay." So,
yeah,
I could just plug everything in and wait a few minutes while things warm up and get the fantastic results like I did with many people that were there filming, along with radio host Rob Simone, who was there. And Paul.
Well, I've done a certain amount of mountain climbing in Colorado here where we have electrical storms, and I certainly am familiar with the beard, hair standing on end and the tingling sensation. So I suppose it's a little similar to that, is it?
Well, it could be. I mean, I do use electrostatic projectors in what I'm doing. And along with the radio waves, you do get a tingling sensation if you actually go in there. I wouldn't want to go in there, but it's amazing how I was able to control it in the confined space in there.
Yeah.
When the Disclosure Project people filmed it, it actually lifted up 1,500 pounds of stuff that was suspended from the ceiling, causing the building to shake a little bit. Actually, that's out there somewhere on the internet under 2006. I think it's a full hour long. I got links to it on my YouTube channel, but I've been noticing lately that there's a lot of videos that are being put out there on what I did. Even some of the two-hour-long Bermuda Triangle TV shows.
So are they still there? Or are they disappearing?
Oh no, they're still there.
Okay.
What I do is I got this Elf digital camera and I just videotape the screen of either the TV set or the internet and put them in my YouTube channel.
Now, how do you get to your YouTube? Is it off of your website then?
It's actually, my channel is John K. Hutchison 2008, and I've uploaded over 2,000 YouTube videos.
Wow.
Some of them are my adventures on the road, of course, and sometimes other strange things. Some of them are hilariously funny. Some of them are totally insane, and a lot of them are from the TV shows I've done.
Well, it sounds like basically you're having, a lot of fun and experimenting and learning things, but you're also kind of on the edge of what is known with the military and electromagnetic weapons, etc. So I'm wondering if you have gotten some negative feedback or negative suggestions from the military as to what you should and shouldn't say in public. Have you been monitored and censored in that manner?
No, not really. They don't seem to care. They actually, I get a lot of emails from the military and NASA people, and they say, well, if you're ever in this region, we'll give you a tour of the NASA base or the one from the Navy Department of the U.S. Pentagon. If you're ever this way, I'll give you a tour. So I make friends with a lot of these folks, and no, I never was.
Yeah, but somewhere I was listening to you did some black ops. Now, you wouldn't be free to speak of that sort of thing.
Well, I don't like giving out names of the individuals that I'm communicating with, but they appear also in TV shows.
Uh-huh.
And are interviewed by film friends of mine, like David Sarita, let's say. But they're very supportive people.
Mm-hmm.
And have appeared other times on TLC talking about my work and actually promoting it and saying that they'll make it work.
Do you run across many other people in your category that come from the background like you out there doing the same type of thing?
Actually, I find people, a lot of experimenters out there that are just starting in this and who are professionals in other areas like machine tool work, or maybe they like to learn and develop these things on their own? I know a lot of professionals that I've all over around the world that I can communicate with that are scientists with PhDs and all that. Ken Shoulders, I can name one there. And others, I get along fine with these folks. But a lot of kids want to start their own laboratory kind of thing. Before I left B.C., Canada, I came here with a letter from a kid, handwritten, saying he wants to make his bedroom look like my place. That's kind of cool. I mean, a lot of kids love this stuff, and they want to get into it. So that's why I put out so much information on YouTube and MySpaces, as well as the blog spot I have, on tons and tons and tons of stuff. So I can just say, well, take a look at this, and maybe you want to play around with it.
Well, that's great. One thing we haven't gotten into that you mentioned early on when you were talking about all the things that are happening out there was this thing called life extension technology. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I've been involved with Dirk Pearson's regime for a long time, where I take handfuls of vitamins and minerals and enzymes, and I noticed that in 1997 there was a news release that they discovered what causes the aging process. It was telomerase enzyme, and Geron Corporation then got all the patent applications for it and developed a couple of years ago a product. And you had to, my goodness, I think it was $25,000 to join their group. Then somebody else came out with the same product for $25 with your own telomerase measuring kit. You can measure your own cells and see how they're doing when you're taking this product. So I've been involved in life extension for a long time and a little bit of life reduction because I smoke cigarettes. But anyway.
Now, is Dirk Pearson is still out there then doing the life extension thing then?
I think Dirk Pearson and Sandy Shaw, who live in Venice Beach, California, they are still with it.
Mm-hmm.
They sort of dropped out of the public eye for a number of years.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of them much.
But I have some friends that know them, and it was a number of years ago they were talking about them. But
so this isn't related to electromagnetic waves or anything. This just has to do with vitamins and enzymes. Okay, so this is a slightly different kind of advances, I guess, huh?
Pretty much, unless you can put yourself in a field and bring your whole biochemistry back 10 or 20.
Right, right, if you get yourself in some zero-point quantum field or something. But it sounds like you might have experimented with that already.
I could have. I feel like I might have.
Well, I was just looking at some of the ads you had on your site, and that was that along the lines that you're talking there? About something you had in your hands that you were advertising for.
Was that my... Let me think now. I did commercials for Paris Hilton's BFF site. Was that the thing you were referring
that
to?
That might have been.
Because that was more of my own little commercial thing I had to do for the competition.
Okay.
Called Dino Dude. I did all those funny commercials for her.
Well, you look like you have a good time with whatever you're doing, that's for sure.
Well, I enjoy doing it. I've done some pretty crazy things, but it may bother my skeptics, but it sure doesn't bother me. And I sure posted a lot of it on the, MySpaces as well as YouTube.
Well, I'm looking forward to looking into some of these videos and DVDs that you've been part of on the Discovery Channel and the History Channel, etc. I think that'll be a real good way to kind of get a little deeper into the topic. They're so reasonable now. You usually get on those sites and you pay $20 and you get a nice little DVD that you can keep. And since I am a professor, sometimes I like to use these in my class. Some can be very stimulating. So I'm looking forward to looking into that angle. But I think for most of us, or at least for myself, a lot of this stuff is very new and exciting and challenging and mysterious to some extent.
Some of the good programs are, I would recommend Beyond Invention.
Uh huh.
That would be a good one. I'm featured in that. There's different lengths. There's 20-minute and 25-minute lengths. I'm featured in that. And there's a lot that hasn't aired yet, which will air any time. So I'd recommend Beyond Invention as well as some of the History Channel shows. Like, I can never keep track of them. They air, and I'm told they aired, and they see me on TV, and I say, well, I asked the folks that email me what program was it. So
maybe they don't even know.
Sometimes they don't. And, you know, I've actually done two programs at the same time. That was funny. One for France, one for, I believe it was Beyond Productions in Australia. And then I did one for Harry DeLuyter. It was pretty cool, too. I was featured in a video called The Race to Zero Point.
Well, John, it's getting about time to bring it to a close, but I really enjoyed this interview. I mean, I could definitely do this again if you're up to it at some point.
Always up to it.
And again, Dr. Carlstrom, thank you. And do you want to give your website again, John? So
I think the best thing with all the links is MySpaces, MySpace.com/John K. Hutchison, HUTCHISON.
And again, I want
to... Yeah, thank you, John. It's been very educational and stimulating, and I'm looking forward to looking at some of these programs and checking out some of these YouTubes because there's sure a lot to learn, and it's exciting stuff. It's potentially revolutionary stuff in terms of our civilization, especially the zero-point energy. And the directed energy weapons, indeed, are scary. And But I'm glad that you have a sense of humor with all this stuff. That's a little reassuring to me.
I have a sense of humor.
Yeah. So, again, thanks very much for coming on the show and educating and enlightening us on this stuff.
Well, thank you very kindly for having me on your show. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, thank you again. And good night.
Okay, good night.
Good night. Take care.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh.
And this is KHENLPFM Radio, 106.9, Salida, Colorado. And again, the views expressed on this program were those of myself.